Luckily, there was a couch in the workroom. It felt like our drip had, in addition to whatever they were testing, some ED-556 in it, which lowers your shame level to like nil. Because soon, there on the couch, off we went. It was super hot between us. And not merely in a horn dog way. Hot, yes, but also just right. Like if you dreamed of a certain girl all your life and all of a sudden there she was in your same workroom. Jeff, Abnesi said, I'd like your permission to pep up your language centers. Go for it, I said, under her now. Drip on, he said. Acknowledge, I said. Me too, Heather said. You got it, Abnesi said with a laugh. Drip on? Acknowledge, she said, all breathless. Soon, experiencing the benefits of the flowing verbaloose in our drips, we were not only fucking really well, but also talking pretty great. Like, instead of just saying the sex-type things we had been saying, such as wow and oh god and hell yes and so forth, we now began freestyling our sensations and thoughts in elevated diction, with 80% increased vocab, our well-articulated thoughts being recorded for later analysis. For me, the feeling was approximately astonishment at the dawning realization that this woman was being created in real time, directly from my own mind, per my deepest longings. Finally, after all these years, was my thought, I had found the precise arrangement of body, face, mind that personified all that was desirable. The taste of her mouth, the look of that halo of blondish hair spread out around her cherubic yet naughty-looking face, she was beneath me now, legs way up, even not to be crude or dishonor the exalted feelings I was experiencing, the sensations her vagina was producing along the length of my thrusting penis were precisely those I had always hungered for, though I had never, before this instant, realized that I so ardently hungered for them. That is to say, a desire would arise, and concurrently, the satisfaction of that desire would also arise. It was as if, A, I longed for a certain heretofore untasted taste, until B, said longing became nearly unbearable, at which time, C, I found a morsel of food with that exact taste already in my mouth, perfectly satisfying my longing. Every utterance, every adjustment of posture bespoke the same thing. We had known each other forever, were soulmates, had met and loved in numerous preceding lifetimes, and would meet and love in many subsequent lifetimes, always with the same transcendently stupefying results. Then there came a hard-to-describe but very real drifting off into a number of sequential reveries that might best be described as a type of non-narrative mind scenery, i.e., a series of vague mental images of places I had never been, a certain pine-packed valley in high white mountains, a chalet-type house in a cul-de-sac, the yard of which was overgrown with wide, stunted Susian trees, each of which triggered a deep sentimental longing, longings that coalesced into and were soon reduced to one central longing, i.e., an intense longing for Heather and Heather alone. This mind scenery phenomenon was strongest during our third bout of lovemaking. Apparently, Abnesti had included some Vivistiff in my drip. Afterward, our protestations of love poured forth simultaneously, linguistically complex and metaphorically rich. I dare say we'd become poets. We were allowed to lie there, limbs intermingled for nearly an hour. It was bliss. It was perfection. It was that impossible thing, happiness that does not wilt to reveal the thin shoots of some new desire rising from within it. We cuddled with a fierceness focus that rivaled the fierceness focus with which we had fucked. There was nothing less about cuddling vis-a-vis fucking, is what I mean to say. We were all over each other in the super friendly way of puppies or spouses meeting for the first time after one of them has undergone a close brush with death. Everything seemed moist, permeable, sayable. Then something in the drip began to wane. I think Abnesti had shut off the verbaloose, also the shame reducer. Basically, everything began to dwindle. Suddenly, we felt shy, but still loving. We began the process of trying to talk après verbaloose, always awkward. Yet I could see in her eyes that she was still feeling love for me, and I was definitely still feeling love for her. Well, why not? We had just fucked three times. Why do you think they call it making love? That is what we had just made three times, love. Then Abnesi said, drip on. We had kind of forgotten he was even there behind his one-way mirror. I said, "Do we have to? We are really liking this right now." "We are just going to try to get you guys back to baseline," he said. "We've got more to do today." "Shit," I said. "Rats," she said. "Drip on," he said. "Acknowledge," we said. Soon something began to change. I mean, she was fine. A handsome pale girl. But nothing special. And I could see that she felt the same re-me, i.e., what had all that fuss been about just now? Why weren't we dressed? We real quick got dressed. Kind of embarrassing. Did I love her? Did she love me? Ha. No. Then it was time for her to go. We shook hands. Out she went. Lunch came in, on a tray. Spaghetti with chicken chunks. Man, was I hungry. I spent all lunchtime thinking. It was weird. I had the memory of fucking Heather, the memory of having felt the things I'd felt for her, the memory of having said the things I'd said to her. My throat was like raw from how much I'd said and how fast I'd felt compelled to say it. But in terms of feelings, I basically had nada left. Just a hot face and some shame, Ari having fucked 3 times in front of Amnesty. 3. After lunch, in came another girl. About equally so-so. Dark hair, average build. Nothing special, just like upon first entry, Heather had been nothing special. "This is Rachel," Apnesty said on the PA. "This is Jeff." "Hi, Rachel," I said. "Hi, Jeff," she said. "Drip on," Apnesty said. We acknowledged. Something felt very familiar about the way I now began feeling. Suddenly, Rachel looked super good. Amnesty requested permission to pep up our language centers via Verbaloose. We acknowledged. Soon, we too were fucking like bunnies. Soon, we too were talking like articulate maniacs, re our love. Once again, certain sensations were arising to meet my concurrently arising desperate hunger for just those sensations. Soon my memory of the perfect taste of Heather's mouth was being overwritten by the current taste of Rachel's mouth, so much more the taste I now desired. I was feeling unprecedented emotions, even though those unprecedented emotions were, I discerned somewhere in my consciousness, exactly the same emotions I had felt earlier, for that now unworthy-seeming vessel, Heather. Rachel was, I mean to say, it. Her lithe waist, her voice, her hungry mouth, hands, loins, they were all it. I just loved Rachel so much. Then came the sequential geographic reveries, see above. Same pine-packed valley, same chalet-looking house. Accompanied by that same longing for place, transmuting into a longing for, this time, Rachel. While continuing to enact a level of sexual strenuousness that caused what I would describe as a gradually tightening chest-located sweetness rubber band to both connect us and compel us onward, we whispered feverishly, precisely, poetically, about how long we felt we had known each other, i.e. forever. Again, the total number of times we made love was 3. Then, like before, came the dwindling. Our talking became less excellent. Words were fewer, our sentences shorter. Still, I loved her, loved Rachel. Everything about her just seemed perfect. Her cheek mole, her black hair, the little butt squirm she did now and then as if to say, mm-mm, was that ever good? "Drip on," Amnesty said. "We are going to try to get you both back to baseline." "Acknowledge," she said. "Well, hold on," I said. "Jeff," Amnesty said, irritated, as if trying to remind me that I was not here by choice, but because I had done my crime and was in the process of doing my time. "Acknowledge," I said. And gave Rachel one last look of love, knowing, as she did not yet know, that this would be the last look of love I would be giving her. Soon, she was merely fine to me, and I merely fine to her. She looked, as had Heather, embarrassed, as in, what was up with that just now? Why did I just go so overboard with Mr. Average here? Did I love her, or her me? No. When it was time for her to go, we shook hands. The place where my MobiPack was surgically joined to my lower back was sore from all our positional changes. Plus, I was way tired. Plus, I was feeling so sad. Why sad? Was I not a dude? Had I not just fucked two different girls for a total of 6 times in 1 day? Still, honestly, I felt sadder than sad. I guess I was sad that love was not real, or not all that real anyway. I guess I was sad that love could feel so real and the next minute be gone, and all because of something Abnesty was doing. 4. After snack, Abnesty called me into control, control being like the head of a spider, with its various legs being our workrooms. Sometimes we were called upon to work alongside Abnesty in the head of the spider, or as we termed it, the spider head. "Sit," he said, "look into large workroom one." In large workroom one were Heather and Rachel side by side. "Recognize them?" he said. "Ha," I said. "Now," Abnesty said, "I'm going to present you with a choice, Jeff. This is what we're playing at here. See this remote? Let's say you can hit this button and Rachel gets some darkened flocks. Or you can hit this button and Heather gets the darkened flocks. See? You choose." "They've got darkened flocks in their MobiPacks," I said. "You've all got darkened flocks in your MobiPacks, dummy," Abnesty said affectionately. Verlaine put it there Wednesday, in anticipation of this very study. Well, that made me nervous. Imagine the worst you have ever felt times 10. That does not even come close to how bad you feel on darkened flocks. The time it was administered to us in orientation briefly for demo purposes, at 1/3 the dose now selected on Abnesty's remote, I have never felt so terrible. All of us were just moaning, heads down, like, how could we have ever felt life was worth living? I do not even like to think about that time. "What's your decision, Jeff?" Abnesty said. "Is Rachel getting the darkened flocks, or Heather?" "I can't say," I said. "You have to," he said. I can't, I said. "It would be, like, random." "You feel your decision would be random," he said. "Yes," I said. And that was true. I really didn't care. It was like if I put you in the spider head and gave you the choice. Which of these two strangers would you like to send into the shadow of the Valley of Death? 10 seconds, Abnesty said. "What we're testing for here is any residual fondness." It wasn't that I liked them both. I honestly felt completely neutral toward both. It was as if I had never seen, much less fucked, either one. They had really succeeded in taking me back to baseline, I guess I'm saying. But having once been darkened flocks, I just didn't want to do that to anyone. Even if I didn't like the person very much, even if I hated the person, I still wouldn't want to do it. 5 seconds, Abnesty said. "I can't decide," I said. "It's random." "Truly random," he said. "Okay, I'm giving the darkened flocks to Heather." I just sat there. "No, actually," he said, "I'm giving it to Rachel." Just sat there. "Jeff," he said, "you have convinced me. It would, to you, be random. You truly have no preference. I can see that. And therefore, I don't have to do it. See what we just did, with your help, for the first time, via the ED-289/290 suite, which is what we've been testing today? You have to admit it. You were in love. Twice, right?" "Yes," I said. "Very much in love," he said. "Twice." "I said yes," I said. "But you just now expressed no preference," he said. "Ergo, no trace of either of those great loves remains. You are totally cleansed. We brought you high, laid you low, and now here you sit, the same emotion-wise as before our testing even began. That is powerful. That is killer. We have unlocked a mysterious eternal secret. What a fantastic game changer. Say someone can't love. Now he or she can. We can make him. Say someone loves too much, or loves someone deemed unsuitable by his or her caregiver. We can tone that shit right down. Say someone is blue because of true love. We step in, or his or her caregiver does. Blue no more. No longer in terms of emotional controllability are we ships adrift. No one is. We see a ship adrift. We climb aboard, install a rudder. Guide him or her toward love, or away from it. You say, all you need is love? Look, here comes ED-289/290. Can we stop war? We can sure as heck slow it down. Suddenly the soldiers on both sides start fucking. Or at low dosage, feeling super fond. Or say we have two rival dictators and a death grudge. Assuming ED-289/290 develops nicely in pill form, allow me to slip each dictator a Mickey. Soon their tongues are down each other's throats and doves of peace are pooping on their epaulettes. Or depending on the dosage, they may just be hugging. And who helped us do that? You did. All this time, Rachel and Heather had just been sitting there in large workroom one. "That's it, gals, thanks," Abnesi said on the PA. And they left, neither knowing how close they had come to getting Darkenfloxed out their wing-wings. Verlaine took them out the back way, i.e. not through the spiderhead, but via the back alley, which is not really an alley, just a carpeted hallway leading back to our domain cluster. "Think, Jeff," Abnesti said, "think if you'd had the benefit of ED-289/290 on your fateful night." Tell the truth, I was getting kind of sick of him always talking about my fateful night. I'd been sorry about it right away and had gotten sorrier about it ever since, and was now so sorry about it that him rubbing it in my face did not make me one bit sorrier, just made me think of him as being kind of a dick. "Can I go to bed now?" I said. "Not yet," Abnesi said. "It is hours to go before you sleep." Then he sent me into small workroom 3, where some dude I didn't know was sitting. 5. "Rogan," the dude said. "Jeff," I said. "What's up?" he said. "Not much," I said. We sat tensely for a long time, not talking. I kept waiting to feel myself all of a sudden wanting to jump Rogan's bones. But no. Maybe 10 minutes passed. "We got some rough customers in here. I noted that Rogan had a tattoo of a rat on his neck, a rat that had just been knifed and was crying. But even through its tears, it was knifing a smaller rat who just looked surprised." Finally, Abnesti came on the PA. "That's it, guys. Thanks," he said. "What the fuck was that about?" Rogan said. "Good question, Rogan," I thought. Why had we been left just sitting there? In the same manner that Heather and Rachel had been left just sitting there. Then I had a hunch. To test my hunch, I did a sudden lurch into the spiderhead, which Abnesti always made a point of not keeping locked to show how much he trusted and was unafraid of us. And guess who was in there? "Hey, Jeff," Heather said. "Jeff, get out," Abnesti said. "Heather, did Mr. Abnesi just now make you decide which of us, me or Rogan, to give some Darkenflox to?" I said. "Yes," Heather said. She must have been on some Vera talk, because she spoke the truth in spite of Abnesti's attempt at a withering, silencing glance. "Did you recently fuck Rogan, Heather," I said, "in addition to me, and also fall in love with him, as you did with me?" "Yes," she said. "Heather, honestly," Abnesi said, "put a sock in it." Heather looked around for a sock, very talk making one quite literal. Back in my domain, I did the math. Heather had fucked me 3 times. Heather had probably also fucked Rogan 3 times, since, in the name of design consistency, Abnesti would have given Rogan and me equal relative doses of Vivistiff. And yet, speaking of design consistency, there was still one shoe to drop if I knew Abnesti, always a stickler in terms of data symmetry, which was, wouldn't Abnesti also need Rachel to decide who to Darkenflox, i.e. me or Rogan? After a short break, my suspicions were confirmed. I found myself again sitting in small workroom 3 with Rogan. Again, we sat not talking for a long time. Mostly he picked at the smaller rat, and I tried to watch without him seeing. Then, like before, Abnesti came on the PA and said, "That's it, guys. Thanks." "Let me guess," I said, "Rachel's in there with you." "Jeff, if you don't stop doing that, I swear," Abnesti said. "And she just declined to Darkenflox either me or Rogan," I said. "Hi, Jeff," Rachel said. "Hi, Rogan." "Rogan," I said, "did you by any chance fuck Rachel earlier today?"
"Pretty much," said Rogan.
My mind was like reeling. Rachel had fucked me plus Rogan? Heather had fucked me plus Rogan? And everyone who had fucked anyone had fallen in love with that person, then out of it? What kind of crazy-ass project team was this? I mean, I had been on some crazy-ass project teams in my time, such as one where the drip had something in it that made hearing music exquisite, and hence when some Shostakovich was piped in, actual bats seemed to circle my domain, or the one where my legs became totally numb below the waist, and yet I found I could still stand 15 straight hours at a fake cash register, miraculously suddenly able to do extremely hard long division problems in my mind. But of all my crazy-ass project teams, this was by far the most crazy-assed. I could not help but wonder what tomorrow would bring. 6. Except today wasn't even over. I was again called into small workroom 3, and was sitting there when this unfamiliar guy came in. "I'm Keith," he said, rushing over to shake my hand. He was a tall southern drink of water, all teeth and wavy hair. "Jeff," I said. "Really nice meeting you," he said.
Then we sat there not talking. Whenever I looked over at Keith, he would gleam his teeth at me and shake his head all wry as if to say, "Odd job of work, isn't it?" "Keith," I said, "do you by any chance know two chicks named Rachel and Heather?" "I sure as heck do," Keith said. And suddenly his teeth had a leering quality to them. "Did you by any chance have sex with both Rachel and Heather earlier today, 3 times each? I said.
"What are you, man, a dang psychic?" Keith said. "You're blowing my mind, I admit it."
"Jeff, you're totally doinking with our experimental design integrity," Amnesty said. "So either Rachel or Heather is sitting in the spiderhead right now," I said, trying to decide.
"Decide what?" Keith said.
"Which of us to darken, Flux?" I said.
"Ache," said Keith,
and now his teeth looked scared. "Don't worry," I said, "she won't do it."
"Who won't?"
Keith said.
"Whoever's in there," I said.
"That's it, guys, thanks," Abnesty said. Then after a short break, Keith and I were once again brought into small workroom 3, where, once again, we waited, as either Rachel or Heather declined to darken Phlox either one of us. Back in my domain, I constructed a who had fucked whom chart, which went like this. Me, Heather and Rachel. Rogan, Heather and Rachel. Keith, Heather and Rachel. Abnesty came in. "Despite all your shenanigans," he said, "Rogan and Keith had exactly the same reaction as you did, and as Rachel and Heather did. None of you at the critical moment could decide whom to darken Phlox, which is super." "What does that mean? Why is it super?" "It means that ED-289/290 is the real deal. It can make love, it can take love away. I'm almost inclined to start the naming process." "Those girls did it 9 times each today," I said. "Peace for all," he said. "Love inclined. You seem pissy. Are you pissy?"
"Well, I feel a little jerked around," I said.
"Do you feel jerked around because you still have feelings of love for one of the girls?" he said. "That would need to be noted. Anger? Possessiveness? Residual sexual longing?" "No," I said. "You honestly don't feel miffed that a girl for whom you felt love was then funked by 2 other guys. And not only that, she then felt exactly the same quality quantity of love for those guys as she had felt for you, or in the case of Rachel, was about to feel for you, at the time that she funked Rogan? I think it was Rogan. She may have funked Keith first, then you penultimately. I'm vague on the order of operations. I could look it up, but think deeply on this." I thought deeply on it. "Nothing," I said. "Well, it's a lot to sort through," he said. "Luckily, it's night. Our day is done. Anything else you want to talk about? Anything else you're feeling?" "My penis is sore," I said. "Well, no surprise there," he said. "Think how those girls must feel. I'll send Verlaine in with some cream." Soon, Verlaine came in with some cream. "Hi, Verlaine," I said. "Hi, Jeff," he said. "You want to put this on yourself or want me to do it?" "I'll do it," I said. "Cool," he said. And I could tell he meant it. "Looks painful," he said. "It really is," I said. "Must have felt pretty good at the time, though," he said. His words seemed to be saying he was envious, but I could see in his eyes, as they looked at my penis, that he wasn't envious at all. Then I slept the sleep of the dead, as they say. 7. Next morning, I was still asleep when Abnesty came on the PA. "Do you remember yesterday?" he said. "Yes," I said. "When I asked which gal you'd like to see on the Darken Phlox," he said. "And you said neither?" "Yes," I said. "Well, that was good enough for me," he said, "but apparently not good enough for the protocol committee. Not good enough for the 3 horsemen of anality. Come in here, let's get started. We're going to need to do a kind of confirmation trial. Oh, this is going to stink." I entered the spiderhead. Sitting in small workroom 2 was Heather. "So this time," Abnesty said, "per the protocol committee, instead of me asking you which girl to give the Darken Phlox to, which the protcom felt was too subjective, we're going to give this girl the Darken Phlox no matter what you say. Then see what you say. Like yesterday, we're going to put you on a drip of Verlaine. Verlaine, where are you? Are you there? What is it again? Do you have the project order?" "Verbalus Veritalk Chatties," Verlaine said over the PA. "Right," Abnesty said. And did you refresh his mobile pack? Are his quantities good?" "I did it," Verlaine said. "I did it while I was sleeping. Plus, I already told you I already did it." "What about her?" Abnesty said. "Did you refresh her mobile pack? Are her quantities good?"
"You stood right there and watched me, Ray," Verlaine said.
"Jeff, sorry," Abnesty said to me. "We're having a little tension in here today. Not an easy day ahead.
I don't want you to darken Flock's heather, I said.
Interesting, he said. Is that because you love her?
No, I said. I don't want you to darken Flock's anybody.
I know what you mean, he said. That is so sweet. Then again, is this confirmation trial about what you want?
Not so much.
What it's about is us recording what you say as you observe Heather getting dark and flocked. For 5 minutes. 5 minute trial. Here we go. Drip on. I did not say acknowledge.
You should feel flattered, Abnesti said.
Did we choose Rogan? Keith?
No.
We deemed your level of speaking more commensurate with our data needs. I did not say acknowledge.
Why so protective of Heather, Abnesti said.
One would almost think you loved her.
No, I said.
Do you even know her story, he said.
You don't. You legally can't.
Does it involve whiskey, gangs, infanticide?
I can't say.
Can I imply somewhat peripherally that her past, violent and sordid, did not exactly include a dog named Lassie and a lot of family talks about the Bible while Grammy sat doing macrame, adjusting her posture because the quaint fireplace was so sizzling? Can I suggest that if you knew what I know about Heather's past, making Heather briefly sad, nauseous, and or horrified might not seem like the worst idea in the world? No, I can't.
All right, I said. You know me, he said. How many kids do I have?
5, I said.
What are their names, he said.
Mick, Todd, Karen, Lisa, Phoebe, I said.
Am I a monster, he said. Do I remember birthdays around here?
When a certain individual got athlete's foot on his groin on a Sunday, did a certain other individual drive over to Rexall and pick up the cream, paying for it with his own personal money?
That was a nice thing he'd done, but it seemed kind of unprofessional to bring it up now.
Jeff, Abnesti said,
what do you want me to say here?
Do you want me to say that your Fridays are at risk?
I can easily say that.
Which was cheap. My Fridays meant a lot to me, and he knew that. Fridays I got to Skype Mom.
How long do we give you, Abnesti said.
5 minutes, I said.
How about we make it 10,
Abnesti said. Mom always looked heartsick when our time was up. It had almost killed her when they arrested me. The trial had almost killed her. She'd spent her savings to get me out of real jail and in here. When I was a kid, she'd had long brown hair past her waist. During the trial, she cut it. Then it went gray. Now it was just a white poof about the size of a cap.
Drip on, Abnesti said.
Acknowledge, I said.
Okay to pep up your language centers, he said.
Fine, I said.
Heather, hello, he said.
Good morning, Heather said.
Drip on, he said.
Acknowledge, Heather said.
Abnesti used his remote. The darkened flock started flowing. Soon Heather was softly crying, then was up and pacing, then jaggedly crying, a little hysterical even.
I don't like this, she said in a quaking voice.
Then she threw up in the trash can.
Speak, Jeff, Abnesti said to me. Speak a lot. Speak in detail. Let's make something useful of this, shall we?
Everything in my drip felt grade A. Suddenly, I was waxing poetic. I was waxing poetic, re what Heather was doing, and waxing poetic, re my feelings about what Heather was doing. Basically, what I was feeling was, every human is born of man and woman. Every human at birth is, or at least has the potential to be, beloved of his, her, mother, father. Thus every human is worthy of love. As I watched Heather suffer, a great tenderness suffused my body, a tenderness hard to distinguish from a sort of vast existential nausea. To wit, why are such beautiful, beloved vessels made slaves to so much pain? Heather presented as a bundle of pain receptors. Heather's mind was fluid and could be ruined by pain, by sadness. Why? Why was she made this way? Why so fragile? Poor child, I was thinking. Poor girl. Who loved you? Who loves you?
Hang in there, Jeff, Abnesti said. Verlaine, what do you think? Any vestige of romantic love in Jeff's verbal commentary?
I'd say no, Verlaine said over the PA. That's all just pretty much basic human feeling right there.
Excellent, Abnesti said. Time remaining.
2 minutes, Verlaine said.
I found what happened next very hard to watch. Under the influence of the Verbalus, the Veritalk, and the Chatties, I also found it impossible not to narrate. In each workroom was a couch, a desk, and a chair, all, by design, impossible to disassemble. Heather now began disassembling her impossible-to-disassemble chair. Her face was a mask of rage. She drove her head into the wall. Like a wrathful prodigy, Heather, beloved of someone, managed in her great sadness-fueled rage to disassemble the chair while continuing to drive her head into the wall.
"Jesus," Verlaine said.
"Verlaine, buck up," Abnesi said. "Jeff, stop crying. Contrary to what you might think, there's not much data in crying. Use your words. Don't make this in vain."
I used my words. I spoke volumes, was precise. I described and redescribed what I was feeling as I watched Heather do what she now began doing intently, almost beautifully, to her face head with one of the chair legs. In his defense, Abnasty was not in such great shape himself, breathing hard, cheeks candy red, as he tapped the screen of his iMac nonstop with a pen, something he did when stressed.
"Time," he finally said, and cut the darkened flocks off with his remote.
"Fuck, get in there, Verlaine, hustle it."
Verlaine hustled into small workroom two. "Talk to me, Sammy," Abnesty said. Verlaine felt for Heather's pulse, then raised his hands, palms up, so that he looked like Jesus, except shocked instead of beatific, and also he had his glasses up on top of his head.
"Are you kidding me?" Abnesty said.
"What now?" Verlaine said. "What do I..."
"Are you freaking kidding me?" Abnesty said.
Abnesty burst out of his chair, shoved me out of the way, and flew through the door into small workroom two.
8. I returned to my domain. At 3, Verlaine came on the PA.
"Jeff," he said, "please return to the Spiderhead."
I returned to the Spiderhead.
"We're sorry you had to see that, Jeff," Abnesty said.
"That was unexpected," Verlaine said.
"Unexpected plus unfortunate," Abnesty said, "and sorry I shoved you."
"Is she dead?" I said.
"Well, she's not the best," Verlaine said. "Look, Jeff, these things happen," Abnesty said. "This is science. In science, we explore the unknown. It was unknown what 5 minutes on darkened flocks would do to Heather. Now we know. The other thing we know, per Verlaine's assessment of your commentary, is that you really, for sure, do not harbor any residual romantic feelings for Heather. That's a big deal, Jeff. A beacon of hope at a sad time for all. Even as Heather was, so to speak, going down to the sea in her ship, you remain totally unwavering in terms of continuing to not romantically love her. My guess is Protcom's going to be like, wow, Utica's really leading the pack in terms of providing mind-blowing new data on ED-289/290. It was quiet in the Spiderhead.
"Verlaine, go out," Abnesty said. "Go do your bit. Make things ready."
Verlaine went out.
"Do you think I like that?" Abnesty said.
"You didn't seem to," I said.
"Well, I didn't," Abnesty said. "I hated it. I'm a person. I have feelings. Still, personal sadness aside, that was good.
You did terrific overall. We all did terrific. Heather especially did terrific. I honor her. Let's see this thing through, shall we? Let's complete it. Complete the next portion of our confirmation trial."
Into small workroom four came Rachel.
9. "Are we going to darken flocks, Rachel, now?" I said.
"Think, Jeff," Abnesty said. "How can we know that you love neither Rachel nor Heather if we only have data regarding your reaction to what just now happened to Heather? Use your noggin. You're not a scientist, but Lord knows you work around scientists all day. Drip on."
I did not say acknowledge.
"What's the problem, Jeff?" Abnesty said.
"I don't want to kill Rachel," I said.
"Well, who does?" Abnesty said. "Do I? Do you, Verlaine?"
"No," Verlaine said over the PA.
"Jeff, maybe you're overthinking this," Abnesty said. "Is it possible the darkened flocks will kill Rachel?"
"Sure, we have the Heather precedent. On the other hand, Rachel may be stronger. She seems a little larger."
"She's actually a little smaller," Verlaine said.
"Well, maybe she's tougher," Abnesty said.
"We're going to weight adjust her dosage," Verlaine said. "So..."
"Thanks, Verlaine," Abnesty said. "Thanks for clearing that up."
"Maybe show him the file," Verlaine said.
Abnesty handed me Rachel's file. Verlaine came back in.
"Read it and weep," he said.
Per Rachel's file, she had stolen jewelry from her mother, a car from her father, cash from her sister,
statues from their church. She'd gone to jail for drugs. After 4 times in jail for drugs, she'd gone to rehab for drugs. Then to rehab for prostitution. Then to what they call rehab refresh, for people who've been in rehab so many times they're basically immune. But she must have been immune to the rehab refresh, too, because after that came her biggie, a triple murder. Her dealer, the dealer's sister, the dealer's sister's boyfriend. Reading that made me feel a little funny that we'd fucked and I'd loved her. But I still didn't want to kill her. Jeff, Abnesi said, I know you've done a lot of work on this with Mrs. Lacey, on killing and so forth, but this is not you, this is us. It's not even us, Verlaine said, it's science. The mandates of science, Abnesi said, plus the dictates. Sometimes science sucks, Verlaine said. On the one hand, Jeff, Abnesi said, a few minutes of unpleasantness for Heather, Rachel, Verlaine said. A few minutes of unpleasantness for Rachel, Abnesi said. Years of relief for literally tens of thousands of underloving or overloving folks. Do the math, Jeff, Verlaine said. Being good in small ways is easy, Abnesi said. Doing the huge good things, that's harder. Drip on, Verlaine said. Jeff? I did not say acknowledge. Fuck it, enough, Abnesi said. Verlaine, what's the name of that one? The one where I give him an order and he obeys it. Docile ride, Verlaine said. Is there docile ride in his mobi pack? Abnesi said. There's docile ride in every mobi pack, Verlaine said. Does he need to say acknowledge? Abnesi said. Well, docile ride's a class C, so, Verlaine said. See, that to me makes zero sense, Abnesi said. What good's an obedience drug if we need his permission to use it? We just need a waiver, Verlaine said. How long does that shit take? Abnesi said. We fax Albany, they fax us back, Verlaine said. Come on, come on, make haste, Abnesi said, and they went out, leaving me alone in the spiderhead. 10. It was sad. It gave me a sad, defeated feeling to think that soon they'd be back and would docile ride me, and I'd say acknowledge, smiling agreeably the way a person smiles on docile ride, and then the darkened flocks would flow into Rachel, and I would begin describing in that rapid, robotic way one describes on Verbaloose, Veritalk, and Chatties, the things Rachel would, at that time, begin doing to herself. It was like all I had to do to be a killer again was sit there and wait. Which was a hard pill to swallow after my work with Mrs. Lacey. Violence finished, anger no more, she'd make me say over and over. Then she'd have me do a detailed remembering, re, my fateful night. I was 19. Mike Appel was 17. We were both wastel. All night he'd been giving me grief. He was smaller, younger, less popular. Then we were out front of Frizzy's, rolling around on the ground. He was quick. He was mean. I was losing. I couldn't believe it. I was bigger, older, yet losing. Around us watching was basically everybody we knew. Then he had me on my back. Someone laughed. Someone said, shit, poor Jeff. Nearby was a brick. I grabbed it, glanced Mike in the head with it, then was on top of him. Mike gave, that is, there on his back, scalp bleeding, he gave by shooting me a certain look like, dude, come on, we're not all that serious about this, are we? We were. I was. I don't even know why I did it. It was like with the drinking and the being a kid and the nearly losing, I'd been put on a drip called, like, temper burst or something. Insta-rage. Life ruiner. Hey guys, hello, Rachel said. What are we up to today? There was her fragile head, her undamaged face, one arm lifting a hand to scratch a cheek, legs bouncing with nerves, peasant skirt bouncing too, clogged feet crossed under the hem. Soon all that would be just the lump on the floor. I had to think. Why were they going to darken flocks, Rachel? So they could hear me describe it. If I wasn't here to describe it, they wouldn't do it. How could I make it so I wouldn't be here? I could leave. How could I leave? There was only one door out of the spiderhead, which was auto-locked, and on the other side was either Barry or Hans with that electric wand called the Dissy Stick. Could I wait until Abnesti came in, wonk him, try to race past Barry or Hans, make a break for the main door? Any weapons in the spiderhead? No. Just Abnesti's birthday mug, a pair of running shoes, a roll of breath mints, his remote. His remote? What a dope. That was supposed to be on his belt at all times. Otherwise, one of us might help ourselves to whatever we found via inventory directory in our MOBA packs. Some Bon Vive, maybe, some Bliss Times, some Speeder Up. Some Darken Phlox. Jesus, that was one way to leave. Scary, though. Just then, in small workroom 4, Rachel, I guess thinking the spider had empty, got up and did this happy little shuffle like she was some cheerful farmer chick who just stepped outside to find the hick she was in love with coming up the road with a calf under his arm or whatever. Why was she dancing? No reason. Just alive, I guess. Time was short. The remote was well labeled. Good old Verlaine. I used it, dropped it down the heat vent in case I changed my mind, then stood there like, I can't believe I just did that. My MOBA pack whirred. The Darken Phlox flowed. Then came the horror. Worse than I'd ever imagined. Soon my arm was about a mile down the heat vent. Then I was staggering around the spider head looking for something, anything. In the end, here's how bad it got. I used a corner of the desk. What's death like? You're briefly unlimited. I sailed right out through the roof and hovered above it looking down. Here was Rogan checking his neck tattoo in the mirror. Here was Keith squat thrusting in his underwear. Here was Ned Riley. Here was B. Troper. Here was Gail Orley, Stephen DeWitt. Killers all bad, I guess, although in that instant I saw it differently. At birth, they'd been charged by God with the responsibility of growing into total fuck-ups. Had they chosen this? Was it their fault as they tumbled out of the womb? Had they aspired, covered in placental blood, to grow into harmers, dark forces, life-enders? In that first holy instant of breath, awareness, tiny hands clutching and unclutching, had it been their fondest hope to render, via gun, knife, or brick, some innocent family bereft? No. And yet their crooked destinies had lain dormant within them, seeds awaiting water and light to bring forth the most violent, life-poisoning flowers, said water, light actually being the requisite combination of neurological tendency and environmental activation that would transform them, transform us, into Earth's awful, murderers, and follow us with the ultimate, unwashable transgression. Wow, I thought, was there some Verbalus in that drip or what? But no. This was all me now. I got snagged, found myself stuck on a rooftop gutter, squatted there like an airy gargoyle. I was there, but also everywhere. I could see it all. A clump of leaves in the gutter beneath my see-through foot. Mom, poor Mom, at home in Rochester, scrubbing the shower, trying to cheer herself via thin, hopeful humming. A deer near the dumpster, suddenly alert to my spectral presence. Mike Capel's mom, also in Rochester. A bony, distraught checkmark occupying a slender strip of Mike's bed. Rachel below in small workroom 4, drawn to the one-way mirror by the sounds of my death. Abnesty and Verlaine rushing into the spider head, Verlaine kneeling to begin CPR. Night was falling. Birds were singing. Birds were, it occurred to me to say, enacting a frantic celebration of day's end. They were manifesting as the Earth's bright-colored nerve endings. The sun's descent urging them into activity, filling them individually with life nectar, the life nectar then being passed into the world, out of each beak, in the form of that bird's distinctive song, which was, in turn, an accident of beak shape, throat shape, breast configuration, brain chemistry, some birds blessed in voice, others cursed, some squawking, others rapturous. From somewhere, something kind asked, "Would you like to go back? It's completely up to you. Your body appears salvageable." No, I thought, no thanks, I've had enough. My only regret was Mom. I hope someday in some better place I'd get a chance to explain it to her, and maybe she'd be proud of me one last time after all these years. From across the woods, as if by common accord, birds left their trees and darted upward. I joined them, flew among them. They did not recognize me as something apart from them, and I was happy, so happy, because for the first time in years, and forevermore, I had not killed and never would. Exhortation. Memorandum. Date April 6th. To staff. From Todd Burney, Divisional Director, RE, March Performance Stats.
I would not like to characterize this as a plea, although it may start to sound like one. The fact is, we have a job to do. We have tacitly agreed to do it. Did you cash your last paycheck? I know I did. Ha ha ha. We have also, to go a step further here, agreed to do the job well. Now, we all know that one way to do a job poorly is to be negative about it. Say we need to clean a shelf. Let's use that example. If we spend the hour before the shelf cleaning, talking down the process of cleaning the shelf, complaining about it, dreading it, investigating the moral niceties of cleaning the shelf, whatever, then what happens is we make the process of cleaning the shelf more difficult than it really is. We all know very well that that shelf is going to be cleaned, given the current climate, either by you or the guy who replaces you and gets your paycheck. So the question boils down to, do I want to clean it happy or do I want to clean it sad? Which would be more effective for me? Which would accomplish my purpose more efficiently? What is my purpose? To get paid. How do I accomplish that purpose most efficiently? I clean that shelf well and clean it quickly. And what mental state helps me clean that shelf well and quickly? Is the answer negative? A negative mental state? You know very well that it is not. So the point of this memo is positive. The positive mental state will help you clean that shelf well and quickly, thus accomplishing your purpose of getting paid. What am I saying? Am I saying whistle while you work? Maybe I am. Let us consider lifting a heavy dead carcass, such as a whale. Forgive the shelf whale thing. We have just come back from our place on Reston Island, where there were, one, a lot of dirty shelves, and two, yes, believe it or not, an actual dead rotting whale, which Timmy and Vance and I got involved with in terms of the cleanup. So, say you're charged with, you and some of your colleagues, lifting a heavy dead whale carcass onto a flatbed. Now, we all know that is hard. And what would be harder is doing that with a negative attitude. What we found, Timmy and Vance and I, is that even with only a neutral attitude, you are talking a very hard task. We tried to lift that whale while we were just feeling neutral, Timmy and Vance and I, with a dozen or so other folks, and it was a no-go. That whale wouldn't budge. Until suddenly one fellow, a former Marine, said that what we needed was some mind over matter, and gathered us in a little circle, and we had a sort of chant. We got psyched up. We knew, to extend my above analogy, that we had a job to do, and got sort of excited about that, and decided to do it with a positive attitude. And I have to tell you, there was something to that that was fun. Fun when that whale rose into the air, helped by us, and some big straps that Marine had in his van. And I have to say that lifting that dead rotting whale onto that flatbed with that group of total strangers was the high point of our trip. So what am I saying? I am saying, and saying it fervently because it is important, let's try, if we can, to minimize the grumbling and self-doubt regarding the tasks we must sometimes do around here that maybe aren't on the surface all that pleasant. I'm saying, let's try not to dissect every single thing we do in terms of ultimate good, bad, and different in terms of morals. The time for that is long past. I hope that each of us had that conversation with ourselves nearly a year ago when this whole thing started. We have embarked on a path. And having embarked on that path, for the best of reasons, as we decided a year ago, wouldn't it be kind of suicidal to let our progress down that path be impeded by neurotic second-guessing? Have any of you ever swung a sledgehammer? I know that some of you have. I know that some of you did when we took out Rick's patio. Isn't it fun when you don't hold back, but just pound down and down, letting gravity help you? Fellas, what I'm saying is, let gravity help you here in our workplace situation. Pound down. Give in to the natural feelings that I have seen from time to time produce so much great energy in so many of you in terms of executing your given tasks with vigor and without second-guessing and neurotic thoughts. Remember that record-breaking week Andy had back in October when he doubled his usual number of units? Regardless of all else, forgetting for the moment all namby-pamby thoughts of right, wrong, etc., etc., wasn't that something to see in and of itself? I think that if we each look deep down inside of ourselves, weren't we all a little envious? God, he was really pounding down, and you could see the energetic joy on his face each time he rushed by us to get additional cleanup towels, and we were all just standing there like, wow, Andy, what's gotten into you? And no one can argue with his numbers. They are there in our break room for all to see, towering above the rest of our numbers. And though Andy has failed to duplicate those numbers in the months since October, one, no one blames him for that. Those were miraculous numbers. And two, I believe that even if Andy never again duplicates those numbers, he must still, somewhere in his heart, secretly treasure the memory of that magnificent energy flowing out of him that memorable October. I do not honestly think that Andy could have had such an October If he had been coddling himself or entertaining any doubtful neurotic thoughts or second-guessing tendencies, do you? I don't. Andy looked totally focused, totally outside himself. You could see it on his face, maybe because of the new baby. If so, Janice should have a new baby every week, haha. Anyway, October is how Andy entered a sort of, at least in my mind, de facto Hall of Fame and is pretty much henceforth excluded from any real close monitoring of his numbers, at least by me. No matter how disconsolate and sort of withdrawn he gets, and I think we've all noticed that he's gotten pretty disconsolate and withdrawn since October, you will not find me closely monitoring his numbers. Although, as for others, I cannot speak. Others may be monitoring that troubling fall off in Andy's numbers, although really, I hope they're not. That would not be so fair. And believe me, if I get wind of it, I will definitely let Andy know. And if Andy's too depressed to hear me, I'll call Janice at home. And in terms of why is Andy so disconsolate, my guess is that he's being neurotic and second-guessing his actions of October. And wow, wouldn't that be a shame? Wouldn't that be a no-win for Andy to have completed that record-breaking October and then sit around boo-hooing about it? Is anything being changed by that boo-hooing? Are the actions Andy did in terms of the tasks I gave him to do in room 6 being undone by his boo-hooing? Are his numbers on the break room wall miraculously scrolling downward? Are people suddenly walking out of room 6 feeling perfectly okay again? Well, we all know they are not. No one is walking out of room 6 feeling perfectly okay. Even you guys, you who do what must be done in room 6, don't walk out feeling so super great. I know that. I've certainly done some things in room 6 that didn't leave me feeling so wonderful, believe me. No one is trying to deny that room 6 can be a bummer. It's very hard work that we do. But the people above us who give us our assignments seem to think that the work we do in room 6, in addition to being hard, is also important, which I suspect is why they've begun watching our numbers so closely. And trust me, if you want room 6 to be an even worse bummer than it already is, then mope about it before, after, and during. Then it will really stink. Plus, with all the moping, your numbers will go down even further, which, guess what? They cannot do. I have been told in no uncertain terms at the sectional meeting that our numbers are not to go down any further. I said, and this took guts, believe me, given the atmosphere at sectional, look, my guys are tired. This is hard work we do, both physically and psychologically. And at that point, at sectional, believe me, the silence was deafening. I mean, deafening. And the looks I got were not good. And I was reminded in no uncertain terms by Hugh Blanchard himself that our numbers are not to go down. And I was asked to remind you, to remind us, all of us, myself included, if we are unable to clean our assigned shelf, not only will someone else be brought in to clean that shelf, but we ourselves may find ourselves on that shelf, being that shelf, with someone else exerting themselves with good positive energy all over us. And at that time, I think you can imagine how regretful you would feel. The regret would show in your faces, as we sometimes witness in room 6, that regret on the faces of the shelves as they're cleaned. So I'm asking you from the hip to try your best and not end up a shelf, which we, your former colleagues, will have no choice but to clean, 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 using all our positive energy without looking back at room 6. This was all made clear to me at sectional, and now I'm trying to make it clear to you. Well, I've gone on and on, but please, come by my office, anybody who's having doubts about what we do, and I will show you pictures of that incredible whale my sons and I lifted with our good positive energy. And of course, this information, that is the information that you're having doubts and have come to see me in my office, will go no further than my office. Although I'm sure I do not even have to say that to any of you who have known me all these many years. All will be well and all will be well, etc., etc., Todd. Al Rustin. Al Rustin stood waiting behind the paper screen. Was he nervous? Well, he was a little nervous, although probably a lot less nervous than most people would be. Most people would probably be pissing themselves by now. Was he pissing himself? Not yet, although, wow, he can understand how someone might actually... Let's fire it up, shouted the MC, a cheerleaderish blonde too old for braids, whose braids were flipping around as for some reason she pretended to jog. Are we fighting drugs here today or what? Yes, we are. Do us business people approve of drugs for our kids? No way, we don't. We're very much against that. Do we use drugs ourselves? Kids, those of you who are here, believe me when I say we don't, and never did. Because, as someone who does feng shui for a living, there's no way I could do my feng shui if I was whacked out on crack. Because my business is about discerning energy fields, and if you're cracked up, or on pot, or even if you've had too much coffee, the energy field gets all wonky. Believe me, I know. I used to smoke.
It was a lunchtime auction of local celebrities, a local celebrity being any sucker dopey enough to answer yes when the Chamber of Commerce asked.
So that's why we're here, raising money for Laugh Kids Off Crack and their anti-drug clowns, the blonde shouted, such as Mr. Bugout, who, in his classroom work, with a balloon, makes this thing that starts out as a crack pipe and ends up as a coffin, which I think is so true.
Larry Donfrey of Larry Donfrey Realty stood nearby in a swimsuit. Donfrey was a good guy, good but flawed, not that bright, always tan. Was Donfrey attractive? Cute? Would the bidders consider Donfrey cuter than him, Al Rustin? Oh, how should he know? Did he like guys? Was he some kind of expert judge on the cuteness of guys? No, he didn't like guys and never had. There had been that period in junior high, yes, when he had been somewhat worried that he might perhaps like guys, and had constantly lost in wrestling because instead of concentrating on his holds, he was always mentally assessing whether his thing was hurting inside his cup because he was popping a mild prebone or because the tip was sticking out an air hole. And once he was almost sure he'd popped a mild prebone when he found his face pressed against Tom Reed's hard abs, which smelled of coconut, but after practice, obsessing about this in the woods, he realized that he sometimes popped a similar mild prebone when the cat sat on his groin in a beam of sun, which proved he didn't have sexual feelings for Tom Reed, since he knew for sure he didn't have sexual feelings for the cat, since he never even heard that described as being possible. And from that day on, whenever he found himself wondering whether he liked guys, he always remembered walking exultantly in the woods after the